This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscawain. Monday will mark 25 years since the oil tanker Exxon Valdez veered off course and slammed into Bligh Reef. Millions of gallons of oil spilled into Alaska's Prince William Sound. Those of us old enough to remember can still recall the pictures of wildlife covered in crude. Joining us is Charles Woolforth. He was a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News when he was assigned to cover the Valdez accident and spill. He's also the author of 10 books, including The Fate of Nature. He joins us from Anchorage. Charles Woolforth, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Take us back to March 24th, 1989. And how did you first hear that something had happened in Prince William Sound?
Well, I think I first heard it when I picked up the newspaper. It happened, we say March 24th, but it happened right after midnight. The ship was headed out in the dark after loading and made this turn and never turned back into the channel, ran into the reef. And very shortly, we were aware that this was a really, really big issue. And I was a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News and was dispatched down there, I guess, two days later, with a bunch of other reporters riding in the back of my pickup truck.
And where is this area?
Well, Prince William Sound is a really incredible area. It's sort of an inland sea that is, we've got 3,500 miles of coastline, but highly, many, many islands and bays, and it's almost unpopulated. There's a couple of small Indian villages and a couple of small towns. And it's east of Anchorage on the coast of Alaska. You can see it on any globe. It's a really large area.
Right. And, you know, as reporters, you get sort of like the first news of something happening, and you're never really sure if this is going to be a big deal or if it's going to be not such a big deal. Did you ever have that question in your mind, or was it clear from the very beginning this was going to be a big deal?
It was clear it would be a big deal. I mean, people had been aware of the threat of this happening since before the Alaska pipeline was built in the early 1970s. And, you know, it had been something that activists were talking about right up to the eve of the disaster. I'd spent plenty of time sailing and, doing other things, fishing out in Prince William Sound. It's one of the most beautiful places, I guess it's the most beautiful place I've ever seen. And so when you have a super tanker right in the middle of it that's belching out all this oil, you know, there's no way it could not be a big deal. We didn't know it would be the biggest environmental disaster in history up to that point when we got started, but that became evident 3 days later when the wind came up and just swept the oil through the sound and when it became obvious that there would be no meaningful cleanup.
You mentioned the Alaska pipeline just a minute ago. We should explain that the Alaska pipeline, as I understand it, runs from the North Slope all the way down to Valdez, and that's where this oil tanker was picking up oil, correct?
Yeah, the largest oil field in North America was found in 1968-1969 on the North Slope of Alaska at Prudhoe Bay, and the 900-mile pipeline was built from 73, was finished in 77, and it had been operating for 12 years when the oil spill took place. The oil is loaded in the town of Valdez. It looks like Valdez, but it's pronounced Valdez, and shipped down to the west coast of the U.S., and some of it goes through the Panama Canal to the Gulf Coast for refining. And it was one of those tankers on its way out from Valdez. It hadn't made it to open ocean going through Prince William Sound that ran into the reef.
So you got there a couple of days after it actually ran up on Bligh Reef there. What did you see when you first got there? And could you actually get out to where the spill was?
Well, it wasn't easy because, you know, this is a wilderness area, and the only way to get there is on a helicopter or a float plane or a small boat. I was able to jump on a helicopter pretty quickly after getting there. It took me about a day to manage to find an open helicopter seat. The weather had, as I said, it kicked up, and there was a big storm. And we flew this helicopter out through this stormy weather, just bouncing all over the place. And flew over the tanker and could just see the oil like this horrible hand reaching out from the tanker across the water and across these beautiful, beautiful uninhabited islands, and landed on a beach miles and miles from the tanker, and were immediately up in oil that was 2 feet deep, you know, just wading through oil. And
you were how far away, and you were wading through oil?
Oh, I would probably say five miles away. You know, the oil spill by the time it was done was over 1,000 miles long, and you know, oiled well over 1,000 miles of coastline. And this was right at the beginning. And you know, we're walking on this beautiful, you know, what had been a beautiful rocky beach with this gorgeous rainforest at the back of it, and saw a shape and reached down and pulled out a cormorant out of this muck that had been completely slathered. And
that's a bird?
Yeah, it's a seabird. A lot of people have probably seen it's got a long black neck, and it's a very, very beautiful, graceful bird. And so, you know, and then we realized that any living thing that had been in the way of this was now dead. You know, this poisonous glop that was covering everything. The oil, when it gets whipped up in the wind, it emulsifies into this goo, which they call mousse, because it's like pudding. It's like a chocolate mousse material. And it's extremely sticky and gooey and brown. And so we lived with that for the next, you know, for the rest of the summer. That glop was everywhere, and everywhere it went, it picked up, stuck to everything. And it was like having this glue sort of tear through the wilderness.
What did it smell like?
It smelled like oil. You know, it smelled at first you get the sort of the lighter fractions of the crude that evaporates off, you know, the stuff that they make gasoline out of, and that evaporates within, you know, a few days, and then you have the heavier, gooier stuff, and by the end of the summer, when it's sun baked, it starts to smell like a tar covered roof or a newly tarred road. But there at the beginning, it has more of a chemically sort of oily fuel smell.
Wow, and this is a wilderness area, and you know, a lot of us, when we go out into an area like that, the smell is what really catches us. But to have that overpowered by a petroleum product,
yeah, I mean, it's very upsetting at a very deep level when you have been in these gorgeous areas, and if people have been tide pooling, you know, in the main shore. That's what it's like. You know, it's a rocky, and there are barnacles, and there's just, it's teeming with life from the tiniest level to these sea otters and seals and sea lions and killer whales and eagles and bears and, you know, every kind of a marine life you can imagine is just swirling around you. And then suddenly to have this goo, this rank, smelly goo that, you know, that would, also, you'd have the smell of death, because you'd have all these, you know, rotting animals intermixed with it. It's just overwhelming, and people were just, who saw it, were just couldn't stop crying and couldn't stop just being stunned by it, and getting covered in it. All the people were covered in it too, because it was this huge, huge tar baby. And one of the first things that I recognized seeing it was that it was so far beyond the scope of anything mankind could ever clean up. You know, when 1,000 miles of these gorgeous, lacy, intricate beaches and shorelines where there was no human habitation are covered with this goo. I mean, you can't clean that up. And so for me, the story for the rest of summer was just trying to tell people, look, if you do this, you're not going to be able to clean it up.
Hmm. Do you know how many animals you saw were affected by this?
Me personally? I never counted. No, I guess I would say it felt like an infinite number, because I started looking, you know, I saw dead eagles, I saw dead deer, I saw many, many dead otters, and beautiful birds of every kind, loons and puffins and, you know, cormorants and harlequin ducks and I saw dead seals, and, you know, you certainly stop counting. It's kind of like a wildlife, you know, holocaust. But then I started looking smaller and seeing that, you know, even the barnacles were just falling off the rocks, and you reach down to the tide pools and these tiny little creatures, that I didn't even know what they were, that were all dead, and you know, everything was bleached, and it felt like, you know, that from the tiniest thing, animal to the largest, it just swept everything and just killed everything in its path.
We're talking with Charles Wolforth. He's a former Anchorage Daily News reporter and an author. And our topic is the Exxon Valdez accident and oil spill 25 years after. This Monday is going to be the 25th anniversary. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can email radiotimes@whyy.org, and on Twitter you can reach us at WHYY Radio Times. How long did you cover this spill?
Well, I got down there. I was just a very young cub reporter. You know, I was covering a suburban bureau, and I just ended up not leaving. So it was a tough story to cover because it covered such a large area, and Exxon had rented all the boats and aircraft, so my newspaper ended up buying a boat for me to drive around, and I spent that whole summer just in the field covering every story that I could, and then the following winter covering the aftermath. I'd say I probably was on the story 100% for about a year, and then it really became a big part of my career as I moved into freelance writing, and then I wrote my book, The Fate of Nature, about it, which came out in 2010. I think I had my final word with the book. So about 20 years, put it that way, but not that it's the only thing I covered for 20 years.
Sure. So your employer bought you a boat. We should remind folks, this isn't a place where you can jump in your car and drive to the next town, correct?
Yeah, you know, there's a road that leads to Valdez, and there's a road that leads to the little tiny town of Whittier, and then the actual oil spill is, I'm guessing, 15, 20 miles away from that, and then it extends across a wilderness coast with no roads for another 1,000 miles. So, an enormous area, and getting to it was a huge challenge, and of course, the oil companies weren't prepared for that. They didn't have the ability to get out there, but once they arrived, they rented every boat and airplane in sight, and even everyone was very suspicious at the time. They rented every, you know, stuff they weren't using, so it was difficult for the media to be able to even rent an airplane or a boat to get out there, and that's why we ended up buying the boat.
We're talking about the Exxon Valdez accident and oil spill 25 years later. Our guest is author Charles Wolforth. We have a little bit of a scratchy line. He's joining us from Anchorage, and during the break, we're gonna redial on a different phone and get a little clearer line. But if you want to join the conversation or you have a comment about our discussion, call 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're going to talk more about the Exxon Valdez 25 years later after a break.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcomes clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and weight management. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. Beck Institute proudly supports WHYY.
Imagine not being able to actually see the plants in your landscape. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll name the trees, shrubs, and herbs whose fragrance, feel, and even sound can most delight those who struggle with sight. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
The world moves quickly.
And information is bombarding us from all directions. TV, newspapers, the internet.
You need Morning Edition, NPR's weekday news magazine, to slow down that news.
To help you make sense of it.
Not by accepting the quick, easy answer.
But by asking more questions, digging deeper.
Helping you to understand the story behind the headlines.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
weekday mornings on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. We're talking about the Exxon Valdez spill with author Charles Woolforth. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. In just a few minutes, we're going to learn a little bit more about sea otters and how they fared after the Exxon Valdez oil spill that occurred 25 years ago. Charles Woolforth, I've heard it said that cleaning up an oil spill is not really an accurate way to think about it because really only a small percent of the spilled oil is ever recovered. Is that true in this case?
The getting the oil out of the water is difficult, and if you've got a small amount of it, you could probably get a good percentage of it. In large oil spills, I don't believe they've ever broken 10%, and Exxon Valdez, I think, was maybe down around 7% or so. And that is giving a lot of credit for picking up this emulsified material that includes a lot of water and other stuff. If you see it out there over a vast area, you quickly understand that, the oil is very, very thin layer on the water, and there's simply no way to get it. And once it's spread onto rocks and seaweed and animals and, it attaches to sediment and falls to the bottom of the ocean, and there's no way to get it from there, that it's just not possible. It's simply not, people talk about we need better technology. I don't really think that there will be better technology because I just don't see how you could accomplish it. You can't clean oil off of a pebble beach without disturbing and destroying what's there. So, you just have to not spill it in the first place. It's the only solution.
Can you still find oil in the area today?
Yeah, I know folks who can. I personally don't know the spots, but there's definitely places where you can turn over a few rocks and there'll be oil that's pretty fresh. Folks who were there and sort of have gone back every year, you don't see it if you don't know where to look. But that subsurface oil, sank really deeply into the gaps between these rocks, is still there, and it's hard for it to be removed because those rocks never get turned over, and they're cold, so there's not really any way for the oil to quickly dissolve, and so the toxicity of that oil is constantly being released into the environment, very slowly, just a little bit at a time, but enough to affect the recovery of those areas in terms of their ecosystem. So if you think about it, there might be now a mat of mussels growing on top of the area where that buried oil is, and it picks up the toxicity, and then otters and birds would eat those mussels, and so that continues at a low level.
We're going to switch topics a little bit here. Charles Woolforth will stay with us, and he'll be able to answer your questions a little bit later. The telephone number to call is 1-888-477-9499. And we're going to welcome Brenda Bolacci. She's a research physiologist at the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center in Anchorage. She was the lead author of a recently published report on sea otter recovery in Prince William Sound. She joins us by telephone. Welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you.
Tell us a little about sea otters and where they live there in Prince William Sound. Just kind of introduce us to this critter.
Sea otters, they're distributed throughout coastal areas of the North Pacific. Prince William Sound, in fact, is the most northern point of the range of the sea otters. And prior to the spill, there were perhaps 10,000 sea otters in the sound. And sea otters don't, unlike other marine mammals, they don't have any blubber. They rely on their fur to keep them warm in those very cold waters. And the fur is beautiful. If you think of a sort of, it's better than mink, it's better than beaver, it's beautiful fur, it's very dense, and they have to keep it groomed. They constantly groom the fur, no, not constantly, but they have to spend a lot of time every day grooming in order to maintain the integrity of the fur to keep an air layer against the skin. Mm-hmm. And they also have a very high metabolic rate. So the high metabolic rate and the fur is what allows them to survive in that climate.
And describe to us the first time you saw a sea otter affected by the Exxon Valdez accident.
Well, in fact, Jeff, I was not there in the summer of 1989. I didn't move up until the fall of that year. So I missed that first summer. I missed the horrible situations with the oil daughters being brought into the rescue centers and the carcasses being brought in. So my first real exposure to it was when I saw the carcasses that had been recovered in that first summer, spring and summer, and the carcasses were frozen, and there were close to 1,000 of them that had been maintained in freezer vans. And one of my first jobs was to oversee a team of veterinarian pathologists and vet students who worked with them as assistants. We thawed those carcasses, and we did necropsies on them to the best of our ability because there had not been sufficient time in the first summer to do necropsies on all of them. And we wanted to learn as much as we could about the effects of the oil on the otters, as well as just basic biology. We wanted to get as much knowledge from those carcasses as we could. And so my first coming face-to-face with it was to see these hundreds of oiled carcasses come out of the freezer vans, and we thawed them in a remote area outside of Anchorage. And it must have been very, very, very difficult for the people who were there that summer to see the carcasses come in, because it's awful to see these carcasses. They were just covered with oil.
Sure. You say there were 10,000 sea otters before the spill?
There were about 10,000 living in the Sound, in Prince William Sound overall, and it was the Western Sound that was primarily affected, directly affected by the spill.
And do you know what happened to the population after the spill?
We think that our best estimate, the pre-spill estimate of sea otters in that area, the numbers aren't very accurate. So we have to do, you know, quite a bit of thinking and calculating to try and understand what number died. The estimates for the Sound range anywhere from around 700 animals to close to 2,000, a little over 2,000 dying in Prince William Sound. And we've thought a lot about it. We won't be able to get a better estimate than that, and now it's 25 years later. But probably somewhere between 1 and 2,000 died in the Western Sound.
Wow. So you're talking 10 to 20% of the overall population in that area.
Yes. Yes. Well, the oil came through, and as I heard Charles saying it, you know, when it oils the shorelines and it stayed on the surface close to the shorelines, that's the sea otter has to dive for its food. It will forage either intertidally or in shallow subtidal areas. They can go down perhaps 40, 50 meters to get food, and they'll recover crabs, sea urchins, clams, and so they have to dive for their food, but they live at the surface. So they were very vulnerable. They were vulnerable from the oil ruining the fur. As I said, that fur is critical to stay warm. They were vulnerable to inhalation and then ingestion when they tried to groom and the oil was on their fur. So I think it's well recognized that an oil spill will kill many, if not all, of most of the animals in its path.
Brenda Bellacci is with the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center in Anchorage. She's been studying how the Exxon Valdez oil spill affected sea otters in that area. What have you been looking at over the past 25 years?
The studies have been long-term. We've had good funding from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council to conduct these studies, and we've been able to look at a wide variety of aspects of the sea otter biology, and both population studies as well as individual studies. So we've looked at the health of the animals. We've done studies, histopathology, where we get carcasses. We've actually captured animals and taken small liver samples to try and understand whether there was any damage to the liver. We've looked at blood. We've done studies of their foraging patterns to understand how much they use the intertidal areas relative to subtidal areas. We've followed their movements. We've done surveys of abundance. And one of the most interesting things we've done, and has turned out to be very valuable, we've collected carcasses every spring from the shoreline. So we go out in late April, and we walk shorelines wherever they're walkable, and they're certainly not all walkable. But we cover a lot of shoreline, usually teams of two, and we collect carcasses. And this was also done in the 70s and early 80s, so we had pre-spill data. And from the carcasses, we needed the skull and we needed a tooth. Unless it's a very young animal, we can examine the skull and tell that it was young. And these aren't fresh carcasses at that point. These are animals that would have died over the winter, so they're very rarely fresh. But we can get a tooth, and from the tooth we can get an age, and we can get an understanding of the distributions of the ages at death of the sea otters. And a normal pattern is a lot of very young animals and very old animals, and the middle-aged, what we call prime-age animals, should have high survival, and you should find very few of those. And after the spill, we found that there were a lot of prime-age animals dying, which they were not surviving into old age at the rate they should have been.
And how are sea otters doing today?
Sea otters are doing much better today. We've got 3 years of age distributions, 2011, 12, and 13. Finally, the age distributions are back to a normal pre-spill pattern. So now when we've collected carcasses over those last 3 years, there's a lot of young animals, which is normal. Juveniles have a high risk of mortality in their first year. It's a hard time. But then there are not very many prime-age animals, relatively, and animals are getting old again. So that's one good sign, as well as the abundance of the sea otters. The best of our knowledge, because we're estimating pre-spill abundance, but the abundance in the Western Sound overall, as well as in the most heavily oiled area, the part that was the most affected, the sea otters have come back. The numbers are where we think they would have been had there not been a spill.
Wow. And was there a certain point over that 25 years where you said, okay, this is going to be all right, and those numbers are going to return to where you want to see them?
Oh, you know, Jeff, I think we kept assuming it would happen sooner. If anything, one of the big lessons is that from our perspective, it took a long time. It's been over two decades for this recovery to occur. And if you had asked us in the early 90s what our window of opportunity would be to study sea otters and other species, the Harlequin ducks have been on a similar track. They also use the intertidal area extensively. We would never have guessed it would be two decades of study before we would say, gee, things are better.
Brenda Bellacci
have come back.
Mm-hmm. Brenda Bellacci is a research physiologist at the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center in Anchorage. Thank you so much for joining us today and cluing us in what's happening with sea otters in the spill area. We're going to switch now back to Charles Woolforth. He's a former Anchorage Daily News reporter who covered the Exxon Valdez spill. He's also the author of 10 books, including The Fate of Nature. He lives in Anchorage, which is where he's joining us from. We've talked about animals here, but people were affected too. What is the closest town to the spill area?
Well, the spill is kind of in a spot which is in between different towns. There are two. The Valdez was the town where the tanker was left from, and it may be physically the closest, but the town that was most affected was the town of Cordova, which is a fishing town that's also in Prince William Sound and was really devastated by the oil spill and was studied, fortunately, by some sociologists who looked at the human impact of this kind of disaster on the people, and the results were just extraordinary in terms of the stress that people went through, the loss of income, and the long-term impact of litigation and of not being able to continue their livelihood, loss of fishing permits and fishing boats, and really they found that people really didn't recover. You know, that some people got over it, moved on, some left the town and changed to a different life, and then others died, you know, and their children were replaced and they didn't have this trauma. But in terms of a psychological trauma, it was not something that people got over very easily.
I've heard that the incidence of things like substance abuse and domestic violence and things like that, it increased. Is that what these folks were looking at?
Yeah, they did a pretty sophisticated study where they were doing psychological screening on large numbers of people, and they found stress levels that were
sort of in the same numerical level as people who had been through a death of a family member or you know, a sexual assault. Not that those are equivalent, but that people's lives were just completely turned upside down and they were grieving. And there were certainly increases in the kinds of things you talked about and also increases in suicide. One of the really heartrending things was a few years after the oil spill and fishing had crashed and the town was falling apart, the mayor committed suicide. And
the mayor of Cordova?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And so, you know, and some people simply it was sort of described as a toxic environment, because what happens is that, you know, in natural disasters, there's a tendency of everyone to pull together and see, you know, the enemy is just sort of what's happened and everyone's working together. But in industrial disasters, where there's a lot of money involved and litigation and blame laying, you get a situation where people turn against each other. And so in that summer of the oil spill, some people were able to get contracts and rent their fishing boats out to Exxon, and Exxon was paying very large amounts of money. And so they made more money than they'd ever had before. We started calling them billionaires because of all the money they were making. Others refused to work for Exxon or just couldn't get a contract. And they lost their livelihood. You know, they weren't able to fish, and many lost their permits and boats. And so this created this conflict that really never went away between sort of the people on different sides of how this thing worked out. And then the litigation itself became a horrible stressor that lasted another 20 years. And so that toxic environment, that sort of the breaking up of a community that had been very close, took away people's support. And interestingly enough, these same researchers went down to the Gulf Coast after the BP oil spill and tried to counsel people there, hey, stick together, you know, make sure you know who the enemy is.
These court battles that you mentioned, we just have about 30 seconds here, but could you just kind of give us a summary of what was at stake there and why it took so long? Maybe we just have enough time for what was at stake there.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, there was a criminal case that was settled quickly, and then there was a civil case where the people affected sued Exxon. They got a $5 million verdict, and then Exxon was able to appeal that up and down through the courts for 10 years and have it reduced to $500 million, and really 10% of what had been originally awarded, and not really enough to make much difference in the lives of the people who were affected.
We're talking about the Exxon Valdez oil spill and what happened in Prince William Sound 25 years ago. Author Charles Woolforth is with us for the entire hour. You're welcome to join the discussion at 1-888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org. And on Twitter, you can reach us at WHYY Radio Times. When we come back, we're going to bring in another guest and continue this discussion and look a little bit ahead to the future. Is the country prepared for the next oil spill? We'll be back after a break.
Supporting WHYY Network for New Music is joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Harbison in a series of concerts and workshops from April 4th through April 6th. These events celebrate John Harbison's music and his love of jazz, poetry, and American folk song, with new music by Harbison and Ori Kane, James Primish, Terrell Stafford, Anna Wiesner, Bobby Zankel, and others. For tickets and information about these concerts and workshops, networkfornewmusic.org.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes on our show, here's your chance to find out. On a special Fresh Air broadcast, Friday, March 28th, our producers and I will answer your questions about how we put the show together. To submit your questions, go to the website whyy.org/askfreshair. That's whyy.org/askfreshair. So tell us what you want to know, then tune in March 28th.
For some students, showing up is the whole battle.
Freshman year, I was doing good.
up until January, and then everything just went downhill from there. I started cutting. I cut one time, and then it's like I noticed, you know, like nobody was watching me.
How a high school confronts truancy one student at a time, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowane. We're talking about the Exxon Valdez oil tanker accident and spill that took place 25 years ago on Monday. It'll be 25 years. We have author Charles Woolforth with us from Anchorage. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. And Charles, we were talking about the litigation. Why did it drag on for so long?
Well, I think it went on for such a long time because the Exxon had the opportunity to keep it going on. You know, the way the legal system works, there are many, many avenues for appeal. This is a very complex case with 30,000 plaintiffs, and so it would be appealed to the Court of Appeals, and it would be sent back to the district court, and it would be appealed up again, and then each step would take years and years to be resolved, and people kept thinking it was going to be resolved, and there were folks in Cordova who were expecting to get a big hunk of this money. And if you think about how that affects your life, if you're a regular working person and you think you're going to get some huge hunk of money all at once, it kind of freezes your life if you're not careful, like sort of somebody waiting for a big inheritance. And, you know, I went to Cordova and talked to some folks, you know, 20 years after when the thing was still pending, and they essentially said, you know, it didn't matter at that point what the final judgment was because Exxon had already won. They'd won by showing people that the courts were not going to be able to take care of you. You know, if you were hurt in an oil spill, you're going to wait a generation for relief, and then after a generation, it doesn't matter anymore. And so that was one of the good things that happened out of the BP oil spill. You know, President Obama, I guess somehow got the company to create these large funds for compensation right away. So people knew exactly how much money was on the table, and they've been handing out the money, and they fight about it, and there's obviously disagreements and unfairness that happen. But it's much better than waiting a couple of decades until, you know, a large number of the people have died or moved on.
Charles Woolforth is going to stick with us here through the end of the hour. I want to bring someone else into this conversation right now. David Kennedy is the former Deputy Undersecretary for Operations for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's helped coordinate NOAA's response to hundreds of chemical and oil spills, including the Exxon Valdez and the 2010 BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
There's a saying in the oil industry that all the easy oil is gone, that what's left is for the big private oil companies these days is the hard-to-get oil that's deep underwater or in places like the Beaufort Sea up in the Arctic. Do you think oil companies have the technology and skills they need to drill in places like this?
From what I know, and certainly I'm not a petroleum engineer, I think they do have the technology to drill in places like that. I think the bigger question is, should there be some sort of an accident, do we have the technology and skill to take care of the issue if and when we have an accident? But in terms of actually being able to drill, yes, although, you know, especially as you get into the Arctic, I think that's less and less proven technology, as we've seen in some of the endeavors a couple of years ago with Shell.
And, of course, the cleanup, if there is a problem, that's the concern, and that's where your expertise is. Do they have the technology and skills to do the cleanup?
It depends. I think it's very misleading. The public is misled if they believe that when there is a major event, that there is the technology or skill to clean up all of the oil. Historically, and for this interview, I was counting up how long I've been in the business, and I was a little bit appalled, 38 years. Historically, though, 10 to 15% recovery of whatever product is spilled is a pretty good recovery rate. And so when you think about a spill you need to kind of put it in that context. There are lots of tools, and they're all put to use, especially if you have a major company involved with the pockets to invest in whatever they need. But in the end, what you're going to recover is a pretty small percentage of what ultimately gets spilled.
Have the technologies advanced much over the last 25 years since the Exxon Valdez?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think if you look at Exxon and then you look at BP, there are about four major technologies or approaches that are used, and they're the same. The technology, the kind of the mainstream technology, has not changed. And so you start with manual labor when you clean up a beach. You have skimmers on the water in the open ocean that skim the oil off the surface. You have burning, and you have dispersants. Those technologies, in and of themselves, there are really no new technologies to add to kind of mainstream cleanup. Have we made improvements around the peripheral edges? Yes, we have. I think maybe most notably is in situ burning. As you know, burning was used extensively in BP.
When you say, in situ burning, that just means burning it where it is?
Correct. It means putting a boom around some quantity of oil so that it's contained and has some depth to it, and then torching it and actually burning it. We did that in the Exxon Valdez momentarily until a huge storm blew the oil out into very, very thin layers where we couldn't concentrate it to burn it, but very successful and used extensively in BP. But at any rate, we have about four basic technologies. Have they themselves improved? Yes, I think they have. But we really don't have any new technology that's proven to add to the toolbox that we've had since Exxon.
Now, since the 2010 BP oil spill, there are some big pots of money out there dedicated to research. Do you think, do you see a period here where some advancements are going to be made?
Unfortunately, no. First caveat is I'm not directly involved in those funds and the research, but I did do a little checking, and for the most part, the incredible sums of money that are going into that area really only are touching on maybe dispersants, but some of the other physical, mechanical technologies are not being invested in. I don't see, and I don't believe from talking to people that are a lot closer than me, that there's really much of any kind of an investment being made in some of those other things. A couple of interesting ideas came out of BP. We had an XPRIZE. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but essentially an organization that is dedicated to trying to create competition to develop new concepts, new ideas, new invention. And there was an XPRIZE developed to look at mechanical cleanup skimming that came up. There were, I think, five or six contestants that competed, and they did come up with a new skimmer that could skim three times what other skimmers had done. There was some other technology they didn't win that I think has been adopted in terms of being able to contain oil in heavier seas. That's always a problem with a boom. After a certain sea height and current, you begin to have the oil entrain or go underneath it. So there was some technology there that I think is being adopted. So there was a little bright spot, but I think in general, you're not seeing much investment in new technology.
David Kennedy is a former Deputy Undersecretary for Operations for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. If you can hold on the phone, we also have Charles Woolforth on the line, and we're going to take a few calls from listeners who are calling in with questions. First, let's go to Amy in Burlington City, New Jersey. Amy, you're on Radio Thanks. Times.
Thank you so much for taking my call, allowing me to participate. I was a volunteer in Seward, Alaska, the summer of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and I was actually assigned to the husbandry to observe the sea otters that were brought in oil-soaked. And I know you had asked the previous speaker about her observations, but I just have to say they are constantly grooming themselves, and to see them internalize and digest all this oil that was on their coats was just very traumatic, both for watching and obviously for the animals who were shivering and just trying to cope with the situation.
Amy, thank you for calling into Radio Times. Charles Woolforth, more of that reaction to what you saw, what you saw as a reporter, what Amy saw as someone who was volunteering to help.
Yeah, there were a lot of volunteers who rushed to those communities just wanting to help, and I was on the first boat that got out to try to rescue birds and otters. Everyone was shocked when we saw the oil and so saw how it looked and how desperate the animals were, and then also shocked when we found out how hard it is to catch a sea otter. You know, they're fierce, strong animals and very, very difficult to catch, and yet they're smeared with this oil and you feel this necessity to try to catch them, and really hard to catch ducks and other seabirds, alphas that are in the water and are covered with oil. And then bringing them back, we kind of realized that we were in a little bit of an Exxon publicity stunt, because we were able to catch this tiny, tiny percentage of the animals that were oiled, brought them back to town, and then here was the world media taking pictures of them and showing these kindly volunteers taking care of them, and then only a small fraction of those animals survived and could be released, and then the science showed that almost all the otters that were released then died because they really couldn't rehabilitate them, and not many of the birds, it was a token, sort of meaningless from a wildlife standpoint to release them, and so it kind of felt like, oh, wow, we've just shown the world that you can catch animals and rehabilitate them, and that's really not true, and so it felt like we were, people's feelings and emotions, they needed to do something so badly in the face of this disaster, but we really couldn't do anything.
David Kennedy, a former deputy undersecretary for operations for NOAA, we received a tweet from Margot. She asks, really, we've not come that far in cleanup capability?
I believe that to be true. We have made some big strides, and again, I would call them peripheral. I don't want to in any way suggest they aren't important. So everything from data management to detection to monitoring to analysis, all of those things I think have made some pretty big leaps, including remote autonomous aircraft and underwater vehicles. But those four basic types of cleanup remain the same from Exxon to now. Again, some of the technology surrounding each of those has gotten a lot better. But there is no new silver bullet, at least not that I'm aware of.
Let's go back to our listeners. James from Kimberton, Pennsylvania. James, you're on Radio Times.
Hello. I'm just about to turn 50, and I remember the Valdez disaster as a seminal moment in my life. It led all the way to me promoting new energy, and it was the end of an extraordinary decade with the 70s saw the energy crisis. It's all time when people came together and used their voice, voted with their pocketbooks, and boycotted gasoline stations. And I hope that we can come together and think about boycotting Exxon. I want to thank the reporters for what they've done in keeping these memories alive. It took a few years, but I have not bought one drop of gas from Exxon or Mobil in over 20 years, and I love spreading the message that it is an incredibly easy thing to do. All you got to do is drive down the road. You don't have to call a politician. You don't have to have your name on some watch list. All you got to do is go to another gas station. Wind and solar do not and cannot create disasters.
There's James from Kimberton, Pennsylvania. Thank you for your comment. A call for renewable energy to avoid oil spills in the future. Let's go to Justin from Collingswood, New Jersey. Justin, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was just wondering, the discussion before about the internal community strife between the spillionaires and those who didn't get wealthy, do you think there's some sort of tactic that communities could take prior to an accident, if they know they're a community at risk, sort of agree to a litigation strategy amongst themselves?
Charles Woolforth, do you see a possibility there?
Well, I think people who've been through it are a lot more sophisticated about these things, and it wouldn't happen the same way again. I think it'd be hard for a community that hasn't been through it to really know what they're facing. I would say the one we talked a little bit about prevention and And I think the one thing that was discovered that was really effective was the creation of a Citizens Advisory Council in Prince William Sound, which was funded by an oil company tax. And that is still in existence, and it's really created a spill prevention scheme in the Sound, which is second to none in the world, because they hire engineers and they hire PR experts and lawyers, and they're able to go toe-to-toe with the oil companies and just use the existing governmental systems to improve prevention of oil spills, and that they are the representatives of those towns. So they're, you know, empowering people who are in the ecosystem who care about it. And I would think David would probably agree that prevention is really the solution. I mean, once the oil is spilled, you're just dealing with degrees of disaster. But if you can prevent it by empowering the people who live there, then that's the best thing that you can do.
David Kennedy, you said that there hasn't been a lot of advancement in cleanup capability. Has there been much advancement in trying to prevent a problem in the first place?
Well, certainly out of Exxon Valdez came the Oil Pollution Act. It was something that had been debated and was going nowhere in Congress. Of course, those that are all familiar know that within a very short while, after all the national and world focus on Exxon and this incredibly pristine Alaskan environment drove the Oil Pollution Act to be consummated, and it has done a great deal, I think, in prevention, and the number of spills have dropped over the last many years. I haven't looked at statistics lately, but for quite some time, you saw significant drops in the number of spills, and I think that's directly related. There is
Actually, I think we're going to have to leave it there. David Kennedy is the former Deputy Undersecretary for Operations for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
And Charles Woolforth was a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News back in 1989 when he was assigned to cover the Exxon Valdez accident and spill. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find links to our Twitter handle, our Facebook feed, and there's more information on podcasts. The engineer today is Kevin Griffin. The producers of Radio